AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now it's time for our Friday Forum, and we are joined by Christina Finn, political editor with thejournal.ie, Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, and of course, columnist with thejournal.ie, and Naomi O'Leary, Europe correspondent for the Irish Times. Good morning, one and all, and welcome. Now, I want to start today with the trial of Soldier F, who was accused of murdering James Ray and William McKinney on Bloody Sunday when the parachute regiment shot dead 13 civil rights protesters. Anyway, the verdict was not guilty for Soldier F. But what Judge Lynch said to the court was that he was constrained and limited by the evidence properly presented before it, regardless of whatever suspicions the court may have about the role of Soldier F. I hold that the witnesses have told lies about the events on several occasions. This included in committing perjury twice in the case of Soldier H to Widgery and Savile inquiries. And he said, I'm satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that the soldiers did not need to defend themselves. Therefore, I am sure they did not act in lawful self-defence in shooting persons in Glenfather Park North. Now, Liam Ray, the brother of James Ray, spoke to RT's Morning Ireland, and he had this to say about the verdict.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I'm not deflated. I don't feel down, actually. I think what we got yesterday was a good news story in many, many ways. Obviously, disappointed that Soldier F wasn't convicted, but we had a good idea that that wasn't going to happen. But I think in the summing up that Judge Patrick Lynch gave, that it is patently clear that these soldiers, E, F, G, and H, acted in a murderous manner, entered Glenfather Park, with the intent to kill, and murdered our relatives, shot them in the back as they were fleeing from the soldiers. So I can't be unhappy with that. I have children that live abroad now. They've went on marches with me. They have been solid campaigners, right down to my grandchildren. And at times they get hurt. I understand that because I used to be hurt and angry in the earlier days, and I have to explain to them sometimes because they feel for me, look, son, this is not a bad result.
And that's Liam Ray, the brother of James Ray, talking about the court's decision yesterday. Larry Donnelly, you're a law lecturer, you know stuff of the law. So tell me, what did you make of the verdict?
Well, I think Liam Ray's reaction there is really magnanimous. I think, you know, a tribute to him and a tribute to the other families who pursued justice for so long. It is a fact that when, with the passage of time, it becomes far harder to secure convictions in critical matters. That is a truth across the board. However, I do think the judge's summation will have provided some comfort to the families. And again, that this took so long is in and of itself a pretty big indictment. But again, I'm really have to pay tribute to Liam Ray. I'm taken aback by the things he said, again, as somebody who campaigned for so long, to have that take on what happened.
Yeah, and of course, some of the veterans saying we don't want to be persecuting any more British soldiers, and they took issue with obviously what has been said. But Christina, what did you make of this verdict?
Yeah, I've heard differing perspectives from the witness's family. Obviously, you know, some saying that obviously this is that the judge did give some solace there, but others saying that, you know, the overall investigation, that evidence just wasn't collected the way it should have been years ago. And as he said, perhaps this verdict could be expected. I think there'll be bigger questions now about what this means for, you know, future legacy cases. You know, we've had the legacy legislation now agreed between the UK and Irish government, albeit that it's definitely not perfect, I think, from both sides and both perspectives, but it is something there to be worked on. So I think the next thing will be looking at the other cases that might come and follow from this and what that might mean in terms of getting answers for many of the families who would be involved here.
Naomi?
I mean, I think the big picture is this impunity was deliberate, and it's part of a bigger pattern of delayed and denied justice regarding acts committed by agents of the British state in Northern Ireland. There's many more cases like this. And what you've seen, what we've heard there from the families is just their sheer resilience over the years of trying to get justice for their losses, which have really defined their much of their lives. It's a difficult one to resolve. I think this is something that is going to define really this period of British rule in Northern Ireland, and it's something that you can only feel for the families when you hear those statements.
I mean, it boiled down to he said, didn't it? You know, the soldiers had one version of events, and then you had the harrowing eyewitness accounts of those who were literally under fire from these British Army soldiers, parachute regiment soldiers. So the judge, I suppose he could have jumped down on one side or the other, but given the lack of absolute certainty, I suppose the benefit of the doubt always has to apply in these cases.
It has to, as much as we find that, tough to digest, and as much as it must be tough to digest for the families. But that's the way the law and the system have to operate.
Beyond reasonable doubt.
And Christina's point is very well made. In terms of the evidence gathering, in terms of the cover-up that went on for many years, there's lots of unanswered questions. But my fear is that we'll never truly get to the bottom of all that for all sorts of reasons. And that's why, again, I'm struck by how magnanimous Liam Ray was there. Mm.
Now, speaking of gathering evidence, the Gardaí are very efficient in gathering evidence, would appear, from body cams at City West. Naomi.
Yes, I think the Gardaí have learned from similar incidents and they're now better prepared. Although, obviously, you know, they struggled to control the crowds at points in the initial unrest that we saw at City West. It's in a way useful that these kinds of incidents have arrived in Ireland somewhat later than in other countries, because we can learn from the experience of other countries. This is a pattern that has happened in many European countries and further afield. It's something that's seen as politically useful by radical right groups to broadcast and to fuel unrest like this. So it's something that there's lots of opportunities to learn from when it comes to the response.
And
the
in media,
state.
I mean, we're all fascinated by a fire. So if you want to get pictures from Ireland on Sky News, set something on fire and it will feature on Sky and Fox and BBC and all the rest of them, because, as I say, news loves a fire.
Yeah, because that's what people will click on, isn't it? So it's taking advantage of something in our society, which is that this is a really an emotive issue. And violence will get attention, as you say, but we do have to be careful and always keep things in proportion. Because if you fuel the sense of crisis, it does work in favour of certain political actors that are doing this on purpose.
Christina?
Yeah, we had two reporters, Eimear McCauley and Niall O'Connor, there for both of the nights outside City West. And it was interesting to hear sort of the different perspective of the organisation of those crowds. So there were reports that it was highly organised, I think, on the first evening, that, you know, there was people coming to, you know, it was well
from far and wide.
Yeah, exactly. And there was people even coming from the UK over to attend that, what was originally called as peaceful protest, but I think obviously it didn't go that way in the end. But the second night, Niall O'Connor, our reporter, was there and saying that it definitely felt like it wasn't as organised as the previous night, that there was a lot more youths there. I know people don't maybe agree with the term, but recreational rioting, people turning up just to cause havoc there. So I think there's two different sort of lines of learnings there from the guards in terms of how they handle this. And when we look back at 2023 and the riots that we had in Dublin, I remember watching, the committee meetings with the guards around that, and, you know, some really startling insights coming out about riot gear being left in lockers back in other Garda stations that they had to drive back to their hometown to get to come back.
Now, in fairness, that, although we know what provoked it, the incident that provoked it on Parnell Square, at the same time, the Gardaí were, it would appear, ambushed by what happened that night. They had some forewarning of what was going to happen at City West, because it was being organised online, as we know.
Yeah, for
so,
sure.
So and I they think were well prepared.
There's definitely more awareness now, I think, at a Garda, senior Garda level, about that monitoring of online presence and getting the heads up about what could be coming. Albeit that, yes, the City West one was organised, but there's definitely more awareness, I think, now of those sort of elements online and what could be talked about,
Larry,
and led to bigger issues.
Yeah, I think that to the points Naomi and Christina made, I think that the Gardaí clearly have learned a lot of lessons. I think they were well prepared. I think that maybe it's because I come from a jurisdiction where if you use potentially lethal force against the police, it might be the last thing you do on this earth. So I thought that the Gardaí were remarkably restrained in the face of fireworks being thrown at them, a motorized vehicle in the form of a scooter being driven right at them, that they remained calm and they kept the situation under control. And I think that a lot of us would have said deep in our hearts when we saw those ugly scenes, we saw those protests, we said, turn the water cannons on and teach these people a lesson. But I think under the circumstances, they did their jobs exceptionally well.
It's interesting, though, that we have heard some very sober talk about the local residents, the genuine protesters, saying why they don't want an IPASS centre there, certainly not one as big as it is. They want their hotel back. And maybe they ended up getting more attention because of the bad behaviour of the people who'd no right being there. But I've heard on primetime last night and again this morning on radio, I've heard those voices saying, look, this is the reason. We're not racist. Mm. We don't mind people coming here, working for a living, da-da-da. But please give us back our hotel.
Yeah, there have been locals there speaking about letters that they've written and petitions that they've signed, and particularly taking issue with the government's, I suppose it wasn't overnight, but the purchase of City West, given the situation they were facing in over the last 18 months about the number of asylum seekers they were dealing with. So, yes, I think it definitely has put it perhaps higher on the political.
Yeah, and the Taoiseach has said to me the other day on this programme that, yes, it's about time we had that conversation about the genuine concerns of people. It doesn't make you a racist just because
you have
concerns.
Yeah, but it's interesting because for the last number of 18 months, they've talked, even with Liv Radker, Roderick Gorman, talking about a proper communication campaign. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, the discussion even with locals, but having that bigger discussion and informing people about the misinformation that is out there about asylum seekers, what they're entitled to, what they're not, why don't they get out to work because they're not allowed to get out to work. There was constant talk about that being an issue, a campaign being rolled out publicly. I have heard that that's something being looked at now, but that's very much like the horse is bolted now at this
stage. Now, Naomi, we are not alone in this particular problem when, you know, people from war-torn countries or other places are coming to all countries all across Europe. They all have an issue, really, don't they?
Yeah, geographically, we're the most protected country almost in Europe in terms of just the flow of migration that starts at the southern borders. So this is something that really started in the south and steadily moved up with, you know, people attracted to places where there is economic opportunity as well. So, you know, it's eerie almost to see headlines and reporting of this kind of thing when you had exactly the same thing happening, you know, in the Netherlands 5 years ago, 6 years ago, things like this, when I would have been reporting on it. And it's definitely something that those who think this should be a bigger political issue than it is, they kind of seize these opportunities really to get it on the agenda, and it can end up transforming national politics.
As in the Netherlands.
Yes, exactly. It's very important now how do government parties react, how do opposition parties react? Do they decide to kind of uncritically adopt some of the narratives that are successful in the more radical strands, or, you know, do they find a different way of talking about these issues and addressing things like Christina mentioned, you know, local services, when people are talking about what they're missing, queues for doctors or not being seen or, you know, this kind of thing. That actually isn't to do with immigration necessarily, that's to do with public services provision. So it's a kind of a high risk moment, but we do have the opportunity to learn from what other countries have done.
Now, I want to stay with you, Naomi, to talk about the European leaders deciding that they might borrow some of Vladimir Putin's money to lend to Ukraine, and which wouldn't have to be paid back if Russia refuses to pay reparations to Ukraine for all the damage it's inflicted upon that country. I mean, it's not a done deal yet.
They say they have political agreement that one way or another they're going to cover the costs of Ukraine for the next 2 years. How they do that is the question. The Commission has proposed doing this reparations loan, as they call it, using Russian state assets, which are currently immobilized in Belgium, in Euroclear, financial services company, and in some way kind of replacing that with an IOU to Russia and then getting this money to Ukraine to fund it. It's very high risk. I mean, Belgium has pointed out that if you know, the European Union went ahead and do that, Russia could seize the assets of European countries in Russia, any other assets that they can have their hands on. And Belgium's quite concerned that they might end up having to pay it back. So they want assurances that
mind
they won't
be allowed. A lot of European and other foreign assets have been seized by the Russians anyway. I mean, a lot of stuff, factories and so on, were literally abandoned and closed. Larry, this idea of helping out Ukraine with Russia's own money, it's kind of appealing. There's a a justice about it somehow.
I think there is, you know, and hopefully a deal can be done. I understand why Belgium is nervous on this, to be frank. But it all has to be seen, all the stuff that's happening in the EU summit. One of the other things that's happening is a tentative agreement to reduce the red tape that's often associated with the European Union, fairly or unfairly, both in North America and, I think, here in Europe. All of this has to be seen, I think, against the context of a Trump presidency and the overall inward pivot of the United States, which I don't think is going to be confined to the Trump presidency, and the EU grasping the Netherlands saying, we're going to need to do it an awful lot more because we can't necessarily depend in many ways on the United States. So I think what's happening at the summit has to be seen against that background.
Yeah, and there's always the enemy within and the person of Viktor Orban. And you know, who can put obstacles in the way of anything the EU wants to do.
Yeah, very much so. And we've seen that even, you know, in previous meetings where, you know, he's put a block on things and made things more difficult for things to progress. But I think, yeah, I think it's 200 billion euro in Russian assets. It does seem to be appealing. Even Micheál Martin speaking yesterday saying, you know, there has to be a mechanism here where there's no reward for Russia for making that incursion into Ukraine, that there shouldn't be, that they shouldn't have to pay. It's, you know, they should have to pay something, that it's a rather perverse idea that the rest of Europe should have
now,
to clean
Russia
up.
Russia still goes on exporting oil and gas, and it has this so-called shadow fleet, which means they're not flying under the Russian flag and they get around the sanctions. And Filatov on the News Talk Breakfast actually said there's no such thing as a shadow fleet. So when they lie in such a barefaced way, what do you do with a country like that?
That's a good question, Pat. I think sometimes, you know, when Russia does say things that are obviously not true, it's on purpose. It's almost showing off. It's kind of saying, you know, we don't have to play by the same rules as anyone else. And sometimes it's even to get attention on things like social media, you know. Some of the fake news and stuff that's spread by Russian propaganda machines isn't credible. And it's part of just this confusion that they seem to sow. It's part of a overall hybrid tactics across Europe that are being deployed to try and level the field a different way when they are kind of bogged down in Ukraine, trying to steadily reduce support for Ukraine and other countries and get their victory that way.
And I mean, that could apply to Donald Trump as well. I mean, the master of the art of distraction says things which are patently untrue. I mean, he is trying to persuade everyone in the United States that what Ronald Reagan said about tariffs is a fake video. And it's true. We actually played it long before it surfaced in Ontario. We played it on this program. It is what Ronald Reagan said, that tariffs are bad.
Yeah, and this is in the context of Trump. He's used that as a pretext to cut off all negotiations with Canada on the tariff issue. And Canada has, you know, by releasing this ad, has taken a bold tack. And I think much of people in the world, whether you know, who don't like Donald Trump, who oppose him, will say fair play to you, Canada. The problem is that Donald Trump and the United States have the power to do extraordinary damage to the Canadian economy and hence Canadian society if Canada goes the hardball route.
But Canada is already aiming to market its products elsewhere quite aggressively now.
But that will take time because of the dependency of the Canadian economy on the United States economy. So that's the realpolitik of the situation. What saddens me most is that Canada was always one of the closest allies of the United States, always friends, and to see how the relationship is disintegrated is profoundly sad.
Yeah, and you can see the efforts there going from the Canadian side. You know, Micheál Martin was over there meeting Mark Carney just last month, talking about ramping up trade between Ireland and Canada. I think we have a big trade mission, I think, after the selection where we're going to have key ministers over there. So just like everybody else, like Ireland in itself, looking for diversification given the fallout, I suppose, from the unpredictability of Donald Trump and his tariffs and what the impact might be on the wider economy, both in Europe and Canada.
Just taking it in the round, finally, Larry, I'll ask you this about what Trump is doing to America. You know, USAID, they shut that down and effectively leave the door open to the Chinese or other operators to get in there, damaging American farmers with soya and beef, doing the deal with Argentina, an autocrat, and making enemies of his friends. I mean, what is his game plan?
Well, I think he's responding to an impulse that he sees within his base, which is for the United States to turn inwards. But I think it's being done with very little understanding that it's extremely counterproductive for the United States, and indeed because of the unwieldy, unlikely political coalition he has built for many of his most passionate supporters, including, as you mentioned, the farming community, which right now in the context of a government shutdown is being hit very, very badly, as are others who are dependent upon government programs. So he's doing it ugly. And again, his numbers continue. He seems to be resilient and bulletproof in many respects. But one wonders how long that will go on for, especially in the context of the midterms coming up.
All right, there we have to leave it. My thanks to Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, columnist with thejournal.ie, Christina Finn, political editor with thejournal.ie, and Naomi O'Leary, Europe correspondent with the Irish Times.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.